From WXXI News, this is Weekend Connections, the podcast. I almost stumbled right out of the gate. I didn't stumble, though. I'm here. I'm Evan. How are you?
And I'm Megan. I'm doing well. I'm glad we're keeping this. You get to see all the fun, quirky sides of this podcast.
Let's start in like a super conventional way, right?
Yeah, we should.
Okay, what's the first story?
Well, it's an unexpected place, actually, to start. Hey, yoga is really, really white.
Really white! What we mean by that is yoga studios are often populated by wealthy white people, even though the origins of yoga are very, very different. We sat down with Imani O'Lear, the creator of Yoga for a Good Hood. She's a woman of color who embraces anyone who wants to learn yoga, and she wants to make sure it's less exclusive.
Imani was featured on a mural in Rochester by artist Sarah Rutherford. Rutherford chose five women to paint on the sides of buildings as part of her project, Her Voice Carries. She wanted to highlight the kind of women who do so much to build connected and inclusive communities. We sat down with Imani O'Lear to discuss yoga and more.
As a person of color, one of the things that I am clear on is that on average, I don't see people of color in the yoga studio. And that has me curious. And part of it is that I don't think that the message always translates well to people of color in a yoga studio, or even if it's accessibility. The average cost of a class can be problematic. Now, I work for a studio that I also love, but I'm privileged enough to be able to afford it, and also strong enough to stand in the midst of a room where there isn't a lot of people that look like me. So that began the conversation with myself with how can I create that safe space for others.
Yoga is pretty white.
Yes.
It's pretty wealthy.
Yes. It has become that.
It wasn't always or supposed to be that way.
No.
That's not the history.
I mean, yeah. The other thing about yoga is if we look into the sutras, that the asana, which is just the movements, was never what the yoga was supposed to be about. What it was supposed to be about is looking at the internal stuff that we have going on all the time, the chatter in our brain. And so how can we calm that down? And so people were sitting and meditating, and then their muscles atrophied because they were trying to figure out their true self. So they said, oh, we may need to move a little bit. And that's how yoga kind of came out of that. But it was about self-expression, not how good your butt looks, right? It was the movements were just a way to deepen ourselves into more knowing. And then when I know myself better, I can know you better because I see me in you and I can love you instead of holding all kinds of judgment on you.
What I want to talk a little bit about is how we get yoga to more people, which is part of what you do, right?
Yes.
Because, you know, I recall just a couple of months ago, the United States is not playing in the next World Cup. They didn't qualify. And there was this hand-wringing. How could we be a nation of 330 million people and not find the athletes to field a good enough soccer team to qualify? And then the conversation said, well, we have that many people. But it's become this wealthy sport because you have to do all of these different things. You have to get this equipment. You have to have your kids not in one league with school, but also private travel leagues and all of these things. And it becomes pretty exclusive.
Yes.
The criticism was it became a country club kind of thing, and you limit the pool of people who are possible, and we should not be surprised. But it wasn't meant to be. And you look around the world, and soccer is this egalitarian sport where, you know, people who are some of the most talented people in the world did not come from money. And mm-hmm. and it shouldn't have become like that in this country, but it sort of did. And maybe there's a lesson to learn. Do you see that has happened to yoga, that it wasn't supposed to not be accessible to everybody?
Yes. However, I think that is also an access point for everyone, right? Like that. So I work at a studio as well, and I see people evolving. It may have entered in one way. And then as they continue their practice, they evolve. Mm-hmm. So I don't want to hold judgment on money because that's just, for me, that would be silly to hold judgment on that. But the other side of it is when it becomes inaccessible for a whole group of people, I think that's problematic. That's with anything. And so how can we narrow that? And so Yoga for a Good Hood begins to narrow that just a little bit to allow some space for people. So I don't, again, I don't see it as good or bad. And I'm very clear about that because, again, I have privilege as well. I don't have the same privileges. But I can enter into a jail and give yoga to women that have felt breathless, have felt tired, used, exploited, and speak a message that their true identity is one of so much love and forgiveness. I can say the same thing to the woman who has $250,000 into her in her bank account easy and say, here's your true identity. And that's what yoga does. I'm just trying to narrow the divide.
Next up, what's up with Bitcoin? Cryptocurrency has exploded this year and in the past few months in particular. It is currency, not backed or regulated by any government. And a single Bitcoin has gone from $100 several years ago to $17,000 this week. There are other kinds of cryptocurrency as well. It's enough to make your head spin or to make you wonder if it's all just going to collapse.
Our panel included Mike Komoransky, a Bitcoin miner and investor, Gary Palmer, the creator of Bitcoin New York, an online resource for investors, and George Conboy, the chairman of Brighton Securities. In this clip, you'll hear all three discussing how Bitcoin has changed, gone more mainstream, and what the future is for cryptocurrency.
The type of user has definitely changed. Today, we're seeing investors, hedge funds, banks getting involved, and we're sort of forgetting about maybe the average person who wants to use it as cash. I used to see people using it for very small purchases, for purchases as small as 4 cents, you know, tipping somebody on the internet for a clever comment, say, here's a penny, and that was easy to do. Well, now you can't do that. It costs you $15 plus a penny. So the use case has changed, and there's alternatives popping up. Bitcoin, whether it's Bitcoin or Bitcoin Cash, Ethereum is very interesting because it's not just money, but it's sort of programmable smart contract type money. It's very, very interesting. And then Zcash and Monero, I won't pick a winner between those two, but if you think Bitcoin's anonymous, wait till you see those two coins, Zcash and Monero.
Okay. Gary.
It's an interesting question. I think it's important to recognize that out of the top 100 coins that are listed on CoinMarketCap.com, I think about 43 of those are based on the Ethereum blockchain. There's a lot of development on the Ethereum blockchain. Of course, I think Bitcoin BTC is going to be number one. I think Ethereum is going to be number two. And then there's lots of different projects beyond that. There's a lot of reasons to look at Ethereum Classic. There's a lot of reasons to look at Omizigo, OMG, Monero, as Mike was saying, Litecoin, Dash. Steemit.com is a social media network on the blockchain.
These are all starting to sound like bad band names.
It sounds like a great name.
It's better in words.
It does. Dash.
Bitcoin, Ethereum, all the rest of them, they're a system devised by humans, like every other system devised by humans. It doesn't mean it's bad. It will go through its ups and downs, and there will be considerable development needed to get it to a point where the optimists project it will be. But I think there's a reasonable case to be made that it will get there. But it's still a system devised by humans. Second, knowledge is power. So if you're thinking about buying, whether it's Bitcoin or Bitcoin Cash or Ethereum or Litecoin, learn about it. Listen to shows like this. Do some reading and be careful. The phrase caveat emptor comes in. Caveat emptor doesn't mean you shouldn't do it. Caveat emptor means know what you're doing before you do it.
Now let's look to the stars. China has just powered up the largest satellite dish in the world, built to search for signs of alien life, like real civilized technological life. The dish is located in the remote Chinese mountains, and China will use it to try to detect radio signals.
And that has prompted a kind of debate over whether this is a good idea. The Atlantic Monthly covered the debate in its December issue, exploring the possible danger of advertising our position to the universe. Some scientists believe in the dark forest concept of the universe. That's a concept that says, well, there are many technological civilizations, but they're hiding because they believe that any contact with other alien life will lead to war.
But Roger Dubey and Brian Koberlein don't think so. They're scientists at RIT who think that there are benefits to making contact, and they doubt that our alien cousins will view us as fresh meat.
The resources that we need to survive are plentiful throughout the universe or galaxy, and the same is true for them. And so I don't see the fundamental driving force of competition that people are afraid of here. I just don't see what causes that to happen. I can see an opportunity for beneficial sharing of information to the benefit of both civilizations, but I don't see how that will give rise to competition. We're just too far apart. We're too sparse. I just don't see how that can happen.
Let's say we get visited, or at least some kind of contact happens, and we are not able to achieve what they are achieving technologically, but we are ready for war should they show up here. I think, obviously, guys, that's a mistake, because anybody who's strong enough to come here, this isn't Hollywood. We're not going to magically figure out a warp drive and to take down their ships when they show up on our miss, and being aggressive would only put us in more danger, I would think. So I actually don't think that would happen. Pragmatically, I think the governments of the world would probably agree on that, that we would hope for a very diplomatic approach.
I certainly would hope so. I think it would be a tragic mistake to assume that the other species is aggressive and that we need to make the first move before they wipe us out. I think that would be a very pessimistic and unfortunate position to take. I think although we would be facing lots of challenges in terms of communicate, learning how to communicate with one another, share experiences, share technologies, etc. That's a very big hill to climb. It would be a shame to destroy that opportunity by being a first aggressor based on sort of a Hollywood vision of what we think aliens are going to do when they get here.
Yeah, fair. Brian?
I agree. I mean, I think we have to understand that if we were to have an alien species that were to visit us, either in person or by some robotic mission, you have to understand how much it would actually take to get here. It would take a tremendous amount of power. So the creation of power would have to be plentiful and easy in their society. It would have to be the recycling of materials. You can only take a certain amount of materials on a spacecraft. You would have to be incredibly efficient. So conservation and recycling has to be incredibly powerful in this technology. Any civilization that can travel across the stars will have to have ready and ample power, ready access to resources, and know how to recycle them well. Then you compound that with the idea that if they have made it that far, they have probably dealt with all the issues of strife and conflict within their own civilization and recognized the downsides of that. And then they get here. What possible reason do they have to destroy us? They wouldn't come here if they didn't know that we were here.
Let's close the week with the Golden Girls.
Thank you for being a friend.
Okay, that's a joke, but we aren't kidding when we say we did talk about the Golden Girls during the show this week. It was actually an unexpected part of a conversation about Star Wars and whether the films still resonate with audiences today. Breaking news, they do.
Our guests helped us preview the new film, The Last Jedi, and they shared what they expect for the future of the franchise. But one caller wanted to go back to the original film in the 1970s because he says it saved his life. In this clip, you will hear the caller, a Vietnam veteran named Bill, talking about how, to him, Star Wars was more than just a movie.
When I got back from Vietnam, I crawled into a bar room and a whiskey bottle, and there was no God in my life, and that was 1974. And at that time, George Lucas and Steven Spielberg got together and they came out with the movie Star Wars. And a bunch of us went on a Thursday night and we saw Star Wars for the first time. I came away with that movie with the opinion that it was okay to believe in a power greater than myself. Not the conventional God, three-letter God word, but just a power, a source. And it allowed me to pursue another avenue of life that basically saved my life. I thank God every day for Lucas and Spielberg for what they put together. It just hit me at the right time in the right place in my hour of need. I was in a really deep pit and allowed me to believe in something greater than myself. And for lack of a better term today, I use the word God in my life. But back then, it was the source. You know, it was the source of all good things. This power greater than myself came from all good living things. Everybody in my life who was trying to help me, back then, I contribute that for the the bright side of the source, let's say. So that's enough, and I'm hopefully I get this kicked off in the right.
Well, thank you,
right,
Bill. You're gonna go see the new one.
I plan on it. I've seen every one of them, and some I've liked, some I haven't. At first, the series was a continuation. They built upon it, but then when they sold the licensing off to another movie set and director, they've gone in a different direction. I think the title, The Last Jedi, I don't think is going to be so forth, The Last Jedi. I think they're going to take this to another level, but I think it's got some interesting... It's still going to be a battle of lightsabers and superb technical movie-ism and photography and digital camera work. And I think there'll be another one somewhere down the road. But I don't think it's going to be the last one.
Well, Bill,
and
thank
so,
you.
Thanks for having this discussion today.
You got it, Bill. Thank you for the phone call, and thanks for sharing. Tiffany, that's a beautiful story, isn't it?
That was incredibly touching. I'm really moved by it because I have a bit of a 12-step background myself, so I've actually never thought about that part of the movies being a trigger for someone and for their spirituality. But absolutely, it's a huge part of the storyline is spirituality and finding a connection to a source greater than yourself that would, you know, move you forward and take you and give you all sorts of powers that you didn't even know you had. That was really moving.
Yeah, thank you, Bill. Yeah. That's nice. Dan, what do you think of that?
I mean, it's fantastic. I mean, I will admit I watched episode 4 last night because why not? And, you know, it was interesting when Obi-Wan is training Luke on the Millennium Falcon and Han Solo makes fun of them and he talks about ancient religions and hokey magic tricks. And I was like, oh, it is interesting that it really is to them. It's a religion. Mm-hmm. You know, in the prequels, they introduced the Jedi temples and it's a way of life for these people that is fulfilling to them. And it's fascinating to hear a parallel to that in someone's personal life.
And if you're wondering how the Golden Girls were part of the Star Wars conversation, check out the podcast on our webpage or watch the 1978 Star Wars Holiday Special.
That is so weird. That was like one of my favorite things. Well, two of my favorite things to discover were the connection in Star Wars of B. Arthur and John Ratzenberger, who played Cliff Clavin in Cheers.
That's right.
So Megan Mack, who is not a Star Wars fan, we found a way.
For me to get interested in Star Wars.
Life finds a way.
Wait, it does.
Life finds a way. That's not a Star Wars line. That's a... Oh, that's Jurassic Park.
I haven't seen either of those movies.
All right. Let's get out of here. that's a Weekend Connections podcast. You can hear Connections every weekday afternoon from noon to 2 on WXXI AM 1370, WRUR 88.5 FM, and WEOS, Finger Lakes Public Radio. Finger Lakes. We're keeping this. We are not doing this again. Finger Lakes Public Radio, 89.5 FM.
We are also on the WXXI mobile app.
We are.
Thanks for listening to all of our stumbles. There's another one this week.
Keep them. No time to re-edit. Bye. Have a nice weekend. And Megan and I will talk to you.